Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you back home, back in our studio in Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush refers to Portland, Oregon. And, boy, there was a reason why last Tuesday I spent most of the, well, I spent an entire hour reading to you from the New York Times from 1928, 1929, 1930, 31, and 32. And Sue has been compiling these things, recompiling that hour. A lot of it is or will be on Sue's stack over at TomHartman.com. I've gotten a lot of emails from people saying, you know, I never heard that stuff. I never read that stuff. Where can I find it? Well, first of all, if you go to NYTimes.com, you have to have a subscription to the New York Times, though, and you can get 100 of the ancient archives a month for free. And so I just, you know, went back in there, spent the whole day reading the New York Times from that period of time. And it's something that you can do as well. Harry Truman, I think, really nailed it. He said this in 1940, and he was talking. Excuse me, Franklin Roosevelt. He was talking about war millionaires and conservative poison. But he began by saying that let's not be afraid.
It is whispered by some that only by abandoning our freedom, our ideals, our way of life, can we build our defenses adequately. Can we match the strength of the aggressors? I did not share those illusions. I do not share these fears. Today we are more realistic, but let us not be calamity howlers and discount our strength. Let us have done with both fears and illusions.
Yeah, let us have done with both fears and illusions. And let's just take a quick look at what has happened. What is the history of the Dow? In 1989, the Dow published their first industrial average. Excuse me, in 1896, and that was 12 stocks, and it was the Dow was at 40 points, 40.94. Okay, it fell in 1896 to 28.48. This was a big crash, the lowest close in Dow Jones history. Then there was a bull market throughout the 20s. It went all the way up to 381. And then this was in 1929, September 3rd, was the peak, 381.17. And on October 28th, it dropped 38 points, which was 12%. And October 29th, it dropped 30.57 points, another 11%. October 30th, it rose 28 points. Up 12%, and then on July 8th, it fell 0.59. And bottom line is that this was the lowest point. 1932, July 8th, 1932, the Dow, which had been at 381 just before the beginning of the Republican Great Depression, in July of 1932, bottomed out at 41 points. This was a decline of 89%. This, by the way, is the institution into which John McCain and George W. Bush want you to put your life savings and us to put Social Security. In fact, as you'll recall, George W. Bush ran for Congress in 1970, as I recall, 77, on the singular platform of privatizing Social Security and putting Social Security into the stock market. We had another big plunge in 1987. This was sometimes referred to as Black Monday. I remember seeing this from a bit of a distance. I was in Europe at the time. It dropped 1,700 points. Excuse me, to 1,700. It dropped 507 points. So in 1987, the Dow was at 1,738. That's not so long ago. In 89, it was up to 2,500. In 91, it was up to 3,000, hit 3,000 for the first time on April 17th, 91. 4,000 in 95, 6,000, 5,000 later in 95, November 21st. This is all during the rising tide lifts all boat. Clinton presidency, oddly enough, hit 6,000 in 96. Hit 7,000 on February 13th, 1997. Hit 8,000 on July 16th, 97. This is what's called a bull market. I mean, it was really roaring along. This was just 1997, hit 8,000. For the very first time. 1998, April 6, 1998, hit 9,000 for the very first time. And in 1999, Bill Clinton was president, the Dow closed above 10,000, March 29th, 1999, for the first time. And here we have today, the Dow is below 10,000 right now. So a lot of people pretty worried about this. Number one, the Dow is not the economy. The Dow, although the Dow does reflect what's going on in the economy to some extent. But here's the thing that is absolutely not being discussed in the media that just makes me crazy that we need to be talking about is the big differences between the crash of 29, and for that matter, the crash of 87 even, and now, and the crash of what's going on right now. Are we sliding into another Republican Great Depression or another Republican Great Recession? You know, the great crash of 87, the savings and loan crisis, this is all the last Bush administration. This is the new Bush administration. So we've got a new Bush recession at the very least. But the big difference is that in the crash of 29 and the crash of 87, we still made things in the United States. In 87, I remember Walmarts all across the United States. Sam Walton was building his brand at that time, and their slogan was Made in America. If you're old enough to remember back 20 years, Walmart's primary slogan, they had these big banners over the front of the store, everything made in America, when Sam Walton was still alive. We still made things in this country. We were still the world's largest creditor. We hadn't, you know, Reaganomics, while it ran us into debt very, very rapidly over the 8 years of Ronald Reagan's presidency, took us from less than $1 trillion in national debt to over $3 trillion in national debt and started whacking at our manufacturing sector. It really took the full 30 years or the full 20 years to do this from largely from 82 to 2008, 26 years. That's how long it's taken to deconstruct the world's largest economy. And now it's running on fumes. And we've got basically one thing holding this thing together, and that is the financial services sector. And as Kevin Phillips writes in his book Bad Money, it's illusion. It's a fantasy. It ain't working, is the bottom line. So, you know, where do we go with it? Well, we'll have to see. But my very, very strong sense is that we are looking at another Republican Great Depression. I just, you know, don't know how to say it beyond that. And the solution? John McCain wants to pay for his so-called health care plan by taxing your health care benefits and by making $1.3 trillion in reductions to Medicare and Medicaid so that he can give a $5,000 tax break to anybody who wants to buy $12,000 or $15,000 worth of otherwise taxable health insurance. Does this remind you of the school voucher program where if people are rich enough to send their kids to a private school, then they get a discount with the school voucher? But if they're not that rich and then they're pretty much stuck with public schools as their only option, the school voucher is worthless because it's not enough to pay for a private school? Yes, it's the same thing. Lobbyists, by the way, circling Washington, D.C. like sharks, George W. Bush, we should stop saying Henry Paulson has $800 billion to pass out or $700 billion pre-pork. Because it's really George W. Bush has $700 billion to pass out. And I guarantee you they're going to privatize this thing. They're going to put together a bunch of their old buddies and cronies, and they're going to say, here's $700,000 million. $1 million, 700,000 times. Pass it out. And, you know, skim a little off the top. I mean, that's what you do when you privatize things. It's like we've got soldiers in Iraq who are making food. Not soldiers. We've got private contractors in Iraq making food for our soldiers. The tragedy of this, the reason why armies always made their own food, they had soldiers doing KP, was if you get overrun, if you get in a problem, you want the cook to be able to pick up a gun and fight too. You don't want the soldiers to have to start defending the cooks, which is the situation we have now. And we're paying these Halliburton guys $150,000 a year for something a GI can do. I mean, this is how bizarre it gets, and this is conventional wisdom. This is just the way that the Republicans think it should be. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Well, Sarah Palin is out there saying, you know, Obama, he's not one of us. He doesn't think like we do. He doesn't see America the way we do. I had a taxi driver drive me out to the airport yesterday in Palm Springs. A guy, I'd guess, in his 60s. Great conversation we had. He's an old pilot, as am I. Although he was a commercial pilot, and I'm just a private pilot. But anyhow, we were swapping stories and having a good time. And we get out near the airport, and he says, what do you think about this election? Who are you going to vote for? And I said, I'm going to vote for Obama. And this is, you know, this guy served in Vietnam, white guy in his 60s. And he shakes his head, and he says, you know, I just can't get comfortable with the guy. And I think we all know what that means. Sarah Palin is out there promoting this, he hangs out with terrorists, he hangs out with William Ayers. Nobody is pointing out, or maybe they soon will be, Sarah Palin talking to the Alaska Independence Party, for example.
I'm Governor Sarah Palin, and I am delighted to welcome you to the 2008 Alaskan Independence Party Convention in the Golden Heart City, Fairbanks.
There you go. And, of course, the founder of the Alaskan Independence Party, who, by the way, was not a friend or mentor of Sarah Palin's, is long dead, but nonetheless, the guy whose voice still resonates through the halls, as it were, of the Alaska Independence Party, a party that her husband was a member of.
The fires of hell are frozen glaciers compared to my hatred for the American government, and I won't be buried under their damn flag. I'll be buried in Dawson. And when Alaska is an independent nation, they can bring my bones home, back to my country.
Back to his country of Alaska. Mm-hmm. But this whole thing, and perhaps the reason why they're not doing this is because it really is a toxic thing. Franklin Roosevelt so nailed this in 1940 when he talked about the undiluted poison. This is his speech. This was his fireside chat from May of 1940, and the topics were the war millionaires that he was going to prosecute. He was going to make sure there were no war millionaires out of this war, and how the Republicans had been fighting him. They had been saying they didn't want to fight Hitler, they didn't want to fight the Nazis, and they were, you know, basically starting to say that there were all kinds of, you know, things flying around. Oh, you know, Roosevelt just wants to help the Jews, blah blah blah, and he just says this is undiluted poison, this stuff. And here's Franklin Roosevelt.
Fortunately, American men and women are not yet easy dupes.
Well, they are now, maybe.
Campaigns of group hatred or class struggle have never made much headway among us and are not making headway now. But new forces are being unleashed. Deliberately planned propagandas to divide and weaken us in the face of danger, as other nations have been weakened before. These dividing forces, I do not hesitate to call undiluted poison.
Franklin Roosevelt. And that, I mean, that's very much what's going on. And you look at the history, you look at, you know, Lee Atwater politics, basically. Michael Dukakis was not defeated on the issues. Michael Dukakis was defeated by having his personality, his personal integrity torn down. To the extent, you know, in my opinion, the last two presidential elections were both stolen, but nonetheless, to the extent that George W. Bush got enough votes to steal an election, he did so because Al Gore's personality was torn down and John Kerry's personal integrity and war record was torn down. That's what these guys have. That's all they have. Jimmy Carter, you know, with the hostages being held and the whole whispering rumor, basically, oh, he's not really a man. He's not standing up. I mean, that was the bottom line. That's what it came down to. And now Sarah Palin is making this explicit. She's making it overt. She's coming right out and saying it. This is basically a racial trashing of Barack Obama. That's the subtext. I can tell you, you know, the taxi driver basically said it to me. You know, he's just not one of us. Come on. We're all Americans here. Who is going to do the better job? Keating Economics, by the way, the Obama campaign, they're starting to say, okay, you're gonna take us on, we'll take you on. KeatingEconomics.com. The documentary is up, and we will be sharing bits and pieces of that with you throughout the day today. And it just went up in the last 5-10 minutes. KeatingEconomics.com. And we'll be getting back to that. But this is, okay, so you're going to talk about Bill Ayers, the guy who was the founder of the Weathermen, who lives in Chicago, who was on a charity board with Barack Obama and did a fundraiser for him in his home. The guys are not friends, they're acquaintances. And Obama has denounced Bill Ayers' behavior when Obama was 8 years old. So you're going to drag that out. Let's talk about John McCain's behavior when he was 58 years old and took $100,000 from Charles Keating to stop regulation and stop investigations into what Keating was doing with the savings and loan. The whole Keating Five and the SNL scandal and Neil Bush, let's look at that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
In broadcasting, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes before the hour. The congressman from California's 27th district, Representative Brad Sherman, on the floor of the House of Representatives before the vote on this $700 billion, what has now become $800 and change with all the sweeteners, the $700 billion authority to give $700 billion to George Bush's man, Henry Paulson. And make no bones about it, this is not Paulson's money. This is Bush's money to play with, because if Paulson doesn't spend it the way Bush wants it spent, Bush will simply replace him with somebody else. Paulson works for Bush. They gave $700 billion to Bush. This is the Bush bailout, not the Paulson bailout. But Bush is so unpopular, he kept himself in the background. And how do we know that this is Bush's bailout? Well, listen to this. This is Congressman Brad Sherman.
The only way they can pass this bill is by creating and sustaining a panic atmosphere. That atmosphere is not justified. Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no.
Now, did you hear that?
That there would be martial law in America if we voted no.
Brad Sherman. Congressman Brad Sherman. Say what? The administration was telling members of Congress you're going to have martial law if you vote no? As Congressman Sherman goes on to say, this is fear tactics at its worst.
That there would be martial law in America if we voted no. That's what I call fear-mongering. Unjustified. Proven wrong. We've got a week. We've got 2 weeks to write a good bill. The only way to write to pass a bad bill, keep the panic pressure on. Now, what has the Senate done to this bill?
And then he goes on into his riff. Yeah, it's like stampede. And now Bush comes out and he says, well, it's going to take a few months before the effects of this bill. Wait a minute, I thought that there was a panic. I thought it was a 24-hour thing. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Barbara in Illinois. Hey, Barbara, listening on WINI. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Good morning. I really appreciate you bringing out the parallels between the Great Depression and the robber barons then and what's happening now.
The Republican Great Depression.
I agree.
Let us name it correctly.
I agree. And I'll go straight to my question. What I don't understand is why we're hearing the wealthy are buying basically our government's debt again at, you know, moving their money into treasury notes, and
right.
I don't understand that. It's buying our debt, and how do we know that anything like that would be honored?
Well,
I
it'll be honored. It'll be honored as long as the country is a country, and then if the United States starts defaulting on its debt, which Argentina, by the way, I don't know if you saw the article. There was a great article about this in The Economist in this last issue.
I saw something on Global Research about it.
Yeah, Argentina basically 3 years ago said, we're defaulting on our debt, and if you turn in your bonds, we'll give you 65% on the dollar, as I recall. And only they don't call it a dollar. I forget what they call their currency, but it was 65%. Take it or leave it. And if you don't turn in your bonds now, you'll get nothing. And 78 or 79% of the people holding that debt turned it in. And a small percentage, 22% or so, held on to their bonds and said, no, I'm holding out. I'm going to wait and get 100%. And so now the president here 3 years later has said, okay, let's negotiate. And, you know, basically dealing with the wealthy and the powerful in that country.
The ones that held their bonds. And
Right. The ones that continue to hold on to the bonds. But that's what happens when a government declares bankruptcy. And when it does, it's an absolute and utter disaster. I mean, it's basically the end of the government in many ways, or at least the end of that incarnation of that government.
Mm-hmm.
If the United States were to default on its bonds, it would be not just an event that would shake the United States. It would rock the planet. I mean, it would be massive. It's not going to happen. I'm telling you, that's not going to happen. And all the rich folks in the world know that's not going to happen, particularly those in America. And the reason why they're willing to go to treasuries, where they're getting less than 0.25% in interest rates right now, which is below the rate of inflation. In other words, the reason why they're willing to lose money is because they know that at least that is not going to go the way that the stock markets may well go. And frankly, commodities may well go as well. I mean, if we go into a full-blown depression, you're going to see the price of gold fall. You're going to see the price of oil fall. You're going to see the price of all commodities fall. Everything is going to fall. And the only thing that's going to have any value is cash. And that's why people, I mean, you know, there'll be some intrinsic value in coins, I suppose, but that's why you've got the really, really wealthy of the world fleeing into treasuries and into bullion. The article I shared with you last week from the front page of the Financial Times about how you know the people who have their own safes, their own vaults, are moving huge bullion bars into them. That's about it. Barbara, thank you for the call and appreciate hearing from you. Michael in Port Angeles, Washington. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Good morning, Tom. I just wanted to tell your listeners about a book I read many years ago called The Day the Bubble Burst. Mm-hmm. About the crash of 29, and it's about some of the people like Joe Kennedy and what happened to them before, during, and after. And they might read that. It's some very interesting reading that pertains to today.
Okay. I'm making a note of it. The Day the Bubble Burst, you know who the author was?
No, I'm sorry. I read it about 20 years ago, but it always stuck with me because I thought, this is going to happen again.
Yeah, yeah. And welcome to again. Thank you, Michael. I'll check it out. I'm sure it's Googleable. Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Long time no talk to.
Yeah, good to hear your voice again, Gary.
Yeah, what's good up? Listen, I wanted to call because I wanted to give you my perspective on what you said earlier and try to add to it. Listen, you are right. You have always been right that the basic premise that you have always said that the comet are under a severe attack.
Yeah.
I think that's what you've been saying is exactly always spot on.
Oh, this is all about privatizing the commons. This is all about stealing. These guys, the Bush administration, they're stealing the china and the silverware on their way out of town.
Exactly. And you deserve the credit for pointing it out to America. I've always been under the same feeling also. But what I really called address specifically what you said, which also was a good point, being in the markets for over 40 years that I have been around the stock market, I've got a long time perspective on exactly what's happening here. And you do bring a good point that even back in 29-30, we had the Walmarts emerging and we had job creation emerging with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Is that correct?
Well, Walmart wasn't started until the 70s by Sam Walton, but the point, yeah, Woolworths and whatnot. Montgomery Ward's is one of the original stocks on the Dow Industrials.
Yeah, here's, Dow. Right. Here's what I'm going to try to bring to the broadcast today. My perspective is exactly this, that this actually, to me, is actually worse than 29.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you why. We have, as you know, and I've called it along with you, we have a cancer in our culture. And what I mean by that is the old, what I describe is, take it while you can and hell with everybody and everything else. Yeah. This is a cancer mentality. That's why I think this is even could be worse than 29.
Yeah. Yeah, a good point, Gary, and thank you for making it. Let me take it a step beyond that. In 29, we still made things in the United States. In 29, we supplied 100% of our own oil. In fact, we were exporting oil to the rest of the world. We were the largest exporter of oil to the rest of the world in 1929. In 1929, we had other countries owing us money rather than the other way around. Things are very different right now than in 1929. Tom in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Good day. How are you?
Good. What's
hey.
Up?
Hey. Just thinking, we know after talking that, or after that guy talked to as well, but we got to shore up the bond market, the interest rates. And I really, really think that we're in a World War III, but it's an economic war. There's not troops and tanks involved. It's going to be all about who can control the finances the quickest.
Yeah, there's been some really interesting pieces written about naked shorts, about people selling stocks that they don't own, they haven't borrowed, they haven't gone to the trouble. Apparently, you're supposed to report when you do short selling without the stock within 3 days, and then you've got an additional 6 days to produce the stock. And so there are a number of companies, particularly some of these financial institutions, AIG and Lehman were among them, where there were literally millions of naked shorts being dumped every single day, day after day after day, driving these things down, and apparently being done by hedge funds, and it's against the law. Or at least it's against the rules. So to some extent, you could say that this thing has been created. On the other hand, maybe it's not so much that it's been created. It's that the people who have figured out what's wrong structurally with the system has said, okay, we're getting out while we still can. And we're going to take as much as we can with us. And that's what's going on. John in Indiana. Hey, John, we got about a minute before the break. What's up? John? No, John. Let's go to Michelle in San Diego. Michelle in San Diego, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I was talking to you on Friday, and I was talking to you about my husband, who worked 31 years for U.S. Airways.
Oh, I remember, yeah.
Yeah,
and
about...
And your phone dropped out.
Yeah, I was on my cell phone. And, there's mandatory retirement at age 60.
Mm-hmm.
About a month before he retired, they announced that they were going bankrupt and had spent his pension, his retirement,
right.
And it was going into the government program, which is also in trouble.
Right.
The PBGA, I think is what it's called.
Right.
And it just seems so unfair. And we also have a small business, and we're required to... refinance a loan, and it's a responsible loan. We're really responsible people, have good credit, and we're having a real hard time finding a new loan for that.
Right.
It would just be a shame to lose the business because of that.
I agree with you, Michelle, and this is the tragedy of this thing. I mean, I'm not gleeful about this at all. This is a real tragedy. Thank you, Michelle, for the call.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Before the hour, KeatingEconomics.com. The destruction of trust.
Fraud is the creation of trust, and then it's betrayal.
Fraud.
Many of our fellow citizens apparently believe that your services were bought by Charles Keating.
The Keating Five involved all the things that have brought the modern crisis. Senator McCain has not learned the lessons and has continued to follow policies and are going to produce a disaster.
And you can see the whole 13-minute video over at KeatingEconomics.com. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dan in Seattle, you're hopeful.
Yeah, I was trying to explain to my father that even though I'm talking about what's going on, trying to inform them, not to lose faith and not to lose hope, mainly because of a lot of the things that Senator Sanders was saying. I've always known that these problems are solvable. I mean, it's real simple. I got the idea from Ralph Nader. Instead of taxing work, tax wealth.
Right.
And Bernie touched on that. I listen to, you know, Brunch with Bernie every Friday. I never miss it. So what he said is, how about a 1% tax on people's net worth over $5 million if there's a budget deficit? That'll go for the deficit.
Right.
10% surcharge on people that make over $1 million a year. That would raise $300 million according to Senator Sanders. And then whatever the rate is, it is whatever the deficit is. Spend the money that we have to spend to rebuild the economy, build out our infrastructure, whatever it takes, and tax the people that benefited from Bush's policies, whatever the rate it takes to balance the budget.
You're absolutely right, Dan. The problem right now is that there's not the will for this in Congress. There's even in the Democratic Party, even if Nancy Pelosi was inclined to do this, she couldn't get a majority of the Democrats in the House of Representatives to go along with it. And even if she did, it wouldn't be a veto-proof majority. And there are no Republicans who would go along with this because there are no moderate Republicans left in the Republican Party. It's been purged and taken over by right-wing cranks. But you're absolutely right. And here's the good news. And, Dan, thanks for raising this. Here's the good news. This is the setup for the solution. Just like it took the crash of 1929 and the Republican Great Depression to show people that three consecutive Republican administrations three consecutive Republican administrations with the laissez-faire attitude, with deregulation, with hands-off, with unregulated markets, it's like a football game without referees and without rules, that is an insane way to play the game of economics. And Americans figured that out in the 1930s, and they said, okay, let's put some rules in place. And we got the Glass-Steagall Act, and we got the Wagner Act, and we got the Social Security Act, and we got the Unemployment Act, and the Glass-Steagall Act, which forbade banks from getting into the speculating business and forbade speculators from getting into the banking business, and the Wagner Act, which made it possible for labor to organize in the United States. It's going to take, and it is taking, another crash, another disaster, or at least the fear of one, to bring about the kind of change that we need. And, you know, God forbid that John McCain and Sarah Palin are elected president and vice president this time around, because they will not produce that change. And we will simply have to endure four more years, just like we did from 1929 till January of 1933 under Herbert Hoover. We had to endure 3 years of it getting worse and worse and worse because Hoover was ideologically incapable of accepting the proposals that were being put forward by Congress. In 1931, Congress passed legislation. In 1932, again, during the election year, they passed legislation that would have put people back to work, extended unemployment benefits for the first time, established a minimum wage. All the things that Franklin Roosevelt did in 33, 34, and 35, they passed that legislation and Herbert Hoover vetoed it. John McCain would veto it. Sarah Palin would veto it. George Bush would certainly veto it. It's like, if you want 4.5 more years of pain and getting a hell of a lot worse, vote for John McCain. It's that simple. On the other hand, if you want this country to get on the right track and you want it to move forward, vote for Barack Obama and vote for as many Democrats as you can. Interesting, by the way, in New Mexico, and I believe it was Santa Fe County, they just discovered that a whole bunch of the voting machines have been programmed so that people who voted straight tickets, if you could just click the yes, entirely Democratic or entirely Republican, their vote for president and their vote for senator would not be counted. Those are the two most highly contested races in that state. Fortunately, they caught that in this highly Democratic district. They caught that programming error. How many places are they not going to be catching those programming errors? Joe in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I have a book. Just got it last week because I, too, was making some analogies as to what's going on now in 1929 through, I guess, about 41. Now, the book, by the way, is War, Prosperity, and Depression, the U.S. Economy, 1917 to 1945. And one other thing, the Federal Reserve, they are not taking, apparently, the heat that they deserve for allowing this to happen. You know, I say it's the not federal Federal Reserve. It's quasi-federal, if that, with a board of governors appointed by guess who? The President of the United States. And who has the President been for the past 8 years? It's the Fed's responsibility to oversee, you know, banks. Here, just give you a quick example. For example, a member bank, private bank, is not permitted to give out too many loans to people who cannot pay them back. This is because too many defaults on loans will lead to a bank run, and so on. And then, nor are they allowed to speculate.
Joe, you're right. You're right. The Fed is a mess, and the Fed is private, and it needs to be bought. The Fed is owned by its member banks, and about a third of the shares of the Fed are actually owned by people outside the United States. The Fed needs to be bought back by the Treasury. You want to spend $800 billion? Buy the Fed. Federalize it. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Carrie Lucas on the line with us. She's the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, the website. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Tom.
It's always great having you with us, Carrie. You've been suggesting in some recent writing that there's a double standard in the reportage, in the reporting about Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Sarah Palin, John McCain, but particularly Sarah Palin because she's a woman. Do I get that right?
Oh, I don't think it's because she's a woman. I think it's because she's new to the scene and has a lot of people a little off kilter on the left. They don't know quite what to make of this this woman, this hunter and avid family woman. So I think that she's been in for some real scrutiny. But there has been. I think that her mistakes, anything she says that seems to be not as perfectly articulated as one would hope from a seasoned politician, everybody jumps on her, thinks it shows that she's stupid, while Senator Biden can get away with making some pretty serious gaffes and errors in fact, and nobody seems to pay much attention to that, or certainly isn't it the big outcry in the press as poor Governor Palin gets.
Well, editor and publisher, you know, the prestigious magazine that is like the trade journal for the news business, ran an article about this. LexisNexis study finds no media bias against Palin or GOP. It turns out that media coverage of GOP Vice Presidential Sarah Palin has actually been quite balanced, with 26% of some 6,000 articles and TV radio reports last week deemed positive, 22% negative, and 52% neutral. Rex Hupke, writing in the Chicago Tribune today, adds, since the media tracking began, the tone of coverage has been almost identical for each top of the ticket candidate. LexisNexis has found, again flying in the face of widespread claims that the media favor Obama over McCain or implicitly Biden over Palin. I would submit to you that there's even something going beyond that, and that's something called white privilege. Can you imagine what would have happened, Kerry Lucas? I mean, this is a serious question. Think about this for a moment. If Barack Obama and Michelle Obama had come up on stage with five kids, one of them an unwed 17-year-old who was pregnant. You still there, Kerry?
Yeah, I'm still here. I mean,
Just think for a minute how America would respond to that.
I don't know. I mean, there probably is some truth to it. I think that there has been such a focus. Both Senator Obama has brought this up a great deal, that there has been such a problem in the African American community of the breakdown of the family, rising illegitimacy rates. So certainly that could have fed into some a stereotype, and it would have been more of a liability for.
But most illegitimate children in the United States are white.
You're probably true. In the same way that Senator, the same way that Governor Palin has come up against some real hard stuff, I think because she's a woman. You certainly didn't have everyone rushing in and saying, "Boy, you know, Senator Obama has small children. How is it that he's going to handle the pressures of the campaign? How is he going to care for his girls?" Where a lot of supposedly good liberal women were out there saying that she basically couldn't be a good mother if she was going to be vice president. So I think yes, there are some double standards.
Actually, my recollection is it was conservatives who were saying that, wasn't it?
Pardon?
It was conservatives. We had a couple of conservative commentators on the program.
There were many women on the left, including some good old liberal reporters. And I just want to say, you know, you can go out there and get this study from. I'll take a look at that study. But I don't think that anybody out there thinks that it passes the laugh test to think that the media doesn't have a stake in this election. It has been patently ridiculous.
They clearly do have a stake in the election. John McCain's $300 billion tax cut to corporations, about $100 billion of that is going to go to some of the largest media corporations in America if he's elected. But, here's another thing. I mean, this is, you know, after all the stuff about Reverend Wright and everything else, Sarah Palin's husband was a member of the Alaska Independence Party for years and years and years. She addressed the party. In fact, here's her address from this year. This is Sarah Palin from this year talking.
I'm Governor Sarah Palin, and I am delighted to welcome you to the 2008 Alaskan Independence Party Convention in the Golden Heart City, Fairbanks.
Okay, so that's her saying, hey, welcome, we're glad to have you here. And here is the founder of the Alaska Independence Party talking about how he thinks, his opinion of America.
The fires they hail are frozen glaciers compared to my hatred for the American government. And I won't be buried under their damn flag. I'll be buried in Dawson. And when Alaska is an independent nation, they can bring my bones home back to my country.
Back to my country, Alaska. Now, why is that getting no coverage? And Reverend Wright was 8 solid days of the news cycle.
You know, that's really interesting. That is the first I've seen of that, and that is appalling. I just think that it's probably because Sarah Palin, this is, she was never a member of this party.
Her husband was for years.
Okay, her husband was for years, and this is something.
I mean, a registered member of it, not just a guy who showed up once in a while, an enthusiastic supporter.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I think that's an absolute legitimate.
And people go nuts about Michelle Obama saying she's really proud of America. Can you imagine if she'd been like, we get this footage of Sarah Palin having demons cast out of her and by a witch doctor, a guy who literally made his reputation driving witches out of towns in Kenya, comes over and casts the demons of witchcraft out of her, and there's, you know, the video of this in Alaska, in her church in Alaska, and that's not portrayed as any kind of big deal. What's going on here?
No, I think this is probably, there aren't, this is legitimate. You know, you should go ahead and people can talk about this and her association with the Independence Party. But you know why? One reason I bet that this hasn't gotten much play, I think it's because of when Senator Obama is sitting back there thinking about if he wants to play the game of whose associations are more reprehensible and are going to be more disturbing to the American public, well, he just wants to try to sit on his lead so people don't start talking about his very recent and very personal relationship with a terrorist who exploded bombs.
You're talking Bill Ayers. And I'm assuming you read the New York Times piece on Bill Ayers?
Pardon? Carrie?
Did you read the New York Times piece on Bill Ayers and Barack Obama day before yesterday?
I thought this was another fantastic example of the New York Times being a little part of the of the Obama campaign machine.
Well, what they basically said was, you know, we've looked into this, CNN looked into it, AP looked into it, reputable news agencies looked into it, and these guys are not friends. They're acquaintances. They were on the board of an organization together, and Bill Ayers is a college professor these days. He's a toothless old college professor.
Do you agree that he did launch Senator Obama's campaign? His political career began in Bill Ayers' house.
That's no, it didn't. Bill Ayers was one of many people who had a fundraiser in his home for Barack Obama that Barack Obama attended early on when he was running for the state Senate. So what? John McCain took $100,000 from Keating to cover up corruption and was, you know, publicly condemned by the U.S. Senate for this. And this is a deal that cost the American people hundreds of billions of dollars while Neil Bush, you know, made off with $500 million in profit. This was a deal that cost the American people terribly. You know, isn't the Keating Five, which happened when John McCain was 58 years old, far more important to the American public than Bill Ayers blowing up bombs when Barack Obama was 8 years old?
Well, except that I think that you've had no one has apologized more and has been more forthright in talking about the mistakes he made in relation to Keating, where Senator Obama has been nothing if not.
But he's making the same mistakes. What he did for Keating was he advocated for and passed legislation that deregulated savings and loans that allowed Keating to make a profit. He has done the same thing for the banking industry. He calls himself a deregulator. He was in favor of blowing up Glass-Steagall. His head economic advisor, Phil Graham, is the guy who wrote the legislation, Graham, Leach, Wiley, that blew up Glass-Steagall that brought us this disaster.
Well, it's really interesting because I think you have a lot of liberals like yourself who have been out there saying, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around. Certainly there have been a lot of mistakes made when it comes to the economy and there's been poor regulation. I think there has a lot of people who have looked the other way, things like letting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac run out of control, pushing a lot of mortgage industries to take on more debt and bad debt. That was a mistake, and that the public policymakers on both sides of the aisle should be held to account for that. But this idea that this is all caused by regulation or lack of regulation is ludicrous. But you know what? This is something that the left is going to is going to use, and we are going to have government grow. This is something we're going to have. I think it's a very sad.
Okay, but Carrie, here's George W. Bush in 2002.
One of the programs is designed to help deserving families who have bad credit histories to qualify for homeownership loans. You don't have to have a lousy home for first-time home buyers.
He's talking about a Fannie Mae Freddie Mac initiative that was being sponsored by his administration. It was called the Ownership Society.
Absolutely. I think
so you could buy a home with lousy credit.
Yeah, absolutely. And the kind of thing that Senator Obama worked on when he was in Illinois and advocating.
And John McCain.
For shadier loans for people with bad credit. There's
and John McCain did it, too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's blame to go around for everybody, but you shouldn't pretend that this is all one side and it's just a conspiracy from.
I'm not pretending that it's all one side. I'm saying it's all coming out of the same ideology, which is that somehow it's best if government stays away from regulating markets.
Do you think that that's something that the government coming in there and saying we are trying to push banks and try to encourage that deregulation is trying to push banks and lenders to give loans to people?
Deregulation allowed the politicians to do that.
Proactive and interventionist government. That's exactly what we don't need. That's the opposite of deregulation.
Deregulation is what allowed Bush to push this kind of thing, and it was the regulations from 1935 to 1999, basically, that prevented this from happening, in my opinion. But Carrie, thanks so much for dropping. But people can read your thoughts on this and your some very, very well written pieces over at the International Women's Forum's website, IWF.org. Kerry Lucas, the VP for Policy and Economics. Always great talking with you, Kerry. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Like I gotta be hot and cold.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Defending America from the Weapons of Conservative Mass Deception. 22 minutes past the hour. Hard-pressed to find good help these days. Not bothered that those helping hands may not be human. Yeah, you could always do what the Japanese tavern Kayabukaya has done, a local hangout just north of Tokyo. They've hired a pair of Japanese monkeys, Yachan and Fuku-chan, to serve their customers. The monkeys pass out hot towels to people before they start their meal, and people tip them with soybeans, boiled soybeans. Isn't that great? It's downright strange. Monkeys coming to a restaurant near you. Sandy in the Chicago suburbs. Hey, Sandy, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was reading that misquote that Sarah Palin did this weekend from Madeleine Albright.
Yes, and Madeleine Albright is quite upset about that. First of all,
very angry because there's a big difference in what was said.
Yeah.
So a place in hell reserved for women who don't support other women. Now, this comes from a woman whose state has, and depending on the report, either the number one incidence per capita of rape, wife abuse and child abuse in the country, or in the top five at least.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing she has done to address that as governor of that state with that appalling statistic is to say there's no abortions even in cases of rape, and in her hometown to vote against support of paying for rape kits when women were raped.
Right. So,
why has no one pulled that out of the locker? This is fair game. She's played the gender card.
Yep. I absolutely agree with you, Sandy, and I think it is fair game, and thank you for bringing it up. It's very well said. And in fact, here's you know, Madeleine Albright, there's a quote from her that's on a Starbucks cup. And Palin said, she says, now she said it, I didn't. She said, she's referring to Albright, she said there's a place in hell reserved for women who don't support other women. Well, in fact, Madeleine Albright is not amused. That's not what she said. She said there's a place in hell reserved for women who don't help other women. And Sarah Palin is a woman who doesn't help other women. You get raped in Wasilla, you have to pay $200 to $1,000 for the forensic kit to try to get the DNA for the rapist. And by the way, in her world, if you get raped in Wasilla or in Alaska, you can't get an abortion. Madeleine Albright says, and these are her actual words, she says, though I am flattered that Governor Palin has chosen to cite me as a source of wisdom, what I said had nothing to do with politics. This is yet another example of McCain and Palin distorting the truth, and all the more reason to remember that this campaign is not about gender. It is about which candidate has an agenda which will improve the lives of all Americans, including women. The truth is, if you care about the status of women in our society and in our troubled economy, the best choice by far is Obama-Biden. And I want to just finish up with my little riff with Kerry Lucas, and then we'll get back to your calls about white privilege. White privilege, Tim Wise wrote this great piece. This is Your Nation on White Privilege. And he says, white privilege is when you can get pregnant at 17, like Bristol Palin, and everyone's quick to insist that your life and that of your family is a personal matter, and that no one has a right to judge you or your parents, because every family has challenges. Even as black and Latino families with similar challenges are regularly typified as irresponsible, pathological, and arbiters of social decay. White privilege is when you call yourself an effing redneck, like Bristol Palin's boyfriend does, and talk about how if anybody messes with you, you'll kick their ass, as he said on his YouTube page, or his MySpace page, rather, and talk about how you like to shoot, expletive deleted, for fun, and you're still viewed as a responsible all-American boy and a great son-in-law to be, rather than a thug. White privilege is when you can attend four different colleges in 6 years like Sarah Palin did, one of which she basically flunked out of and made up some of her coursework at a community college, and no one questions your intelligence or commitment to achievement, whereas a person of color who did this would be viewed as unfit for college and probably someone who got in the first place because of affirmative action. What we're seeing here, people aren't just cutting Sarah Palin slack because she's a woman or because she's a Republican. It's also because she's white. White people don't get this, by and large, what white privilege is. White privilege is being able to have a husband who is a member of an extremist political party that wants your state to secede from the Union and whose motto is Alaska first, and no one questions your patriotism or that of your family. Well, if you're black and your spouse merely fails to come to a 9/11 memorial so she can be home with her kids on their first day of school, people immediately suggest she's being disrespectful. White privilege is being able to fire people who don't support your political campaigns and not be accused of abusing your power or being a typical politician who engages in favoritism, as Palin did, while being black and merely knowing some folks from the old line political machine in Chicago means you must be corrupt. This is John Edwards' Two Americas on steroids, 27 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Past the hour here on your radio support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program. Half the world's mammals are declining in population. And more of this from Agence France-Presse. And more than a third probably face extinction, said an update Monday of the Red List, the most respected inventory of biodiversity. 44,000 animal and plant species they looked at, and a quarter of the planet's 5,487 known mammals clearly at risk of disappearing forever. And they say the situation may even be grimmer than that because they lack data on 836 mammals out of the 5,487 known. In reality, the number of threatened mammals could be as high as 36%, says IUCN scientist Jan Shipper, lead author of the Mammal Survey. The most vulnerable groups? Primates, our nearest relatives in the evolutionary ladder, and marine mammals, including several species of whales, dolphins, and porpoises. This is dangerous. It's like a body losing its organs. This planet is an interconnected web of life, and if a third of all the mammals are at risk of extinction within our lifetime or our children's lifetime, we've got a serious problem. A serious problem. Roland in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Roland, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, listen, I really don't think we're going to see a November 4th election.
Because?
Well, the congressman's comment about Bush threatening martial law, I'm really thinking that they're already looking to invoke Executive Directive 51.
Yeah, this is Congressman Brad Sherman on the floor of the House of Representatives last week.
The market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day. And a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no.
Yeah.
Executive Directive 51 talks about dealing with a catastrophe, and the president can invoke it anytime he declares a catastrophe. And among the listed catastrophes is economic.
You're right. I know. I don't think they're going to do it, Roland. I hope you're wrong. I would assign a very small possibility or probability to that. Although, you know, some kind of a bizarre October surprise, God forbid, a bomb in a major city, an anthrax attack, something like that, would not surprise me at all. And it wouldn't even have to be done by the Bush administration. Keep in mind, in 2004, a week before the election, Osama bin Laden, you know, came out with another video. Why? Because Bush and McCain do exactly what bin Laden wants. Bin Laden's quite explicit about this. He wants to bleed America dry by having us fight an unending war in Afghanistan and pretty much all over the world and ruin our reputation and destroy our economy. And he has gotten exactly what he wants from George W. Bush, and he will get more of the same, exactly what he wants from John McCain. So you know, some sort of an October surprise, particularly a be afraid, be very afraid. I am frankly expecting. It may not even be a false flag operation. Wouldn't have to be. So we'll see. And if that happens and they try to declare it, but I don't think that they're going to suspend the elections. I think that the way that the Bush is going to play this thing is he's simply going to pardon everybody on the way out. He's going to do the same thing his father did. He's going to do the same thing Jerry Ford did. He's going to and that the new administration, they're going to hope that they do the same thing that the Clinton administration did, which is ignore the crimes of the previous administration. So, but we'll see. Steve in Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I want to ask you a question on the bailout bill and the constitutionality of it.
Right.
They first started it in the House and it was defeated, right?
Right.
Okay. So how can the Senate take up a revenue-raising bill and then send it back to the House?
That's a good question. You read the Constitution, and it says all bills, all legislation having to do with revenue have to originate in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, if I got it right here, my Dennis Kucinich copy of the Constitution I got during this campaign.
There you go.
Article 1, Section 7.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that there's some, you know, little technical trick, Article 1,
well,
Section 7.
Let's... I did call Harry Reid's office.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that they piggybacked it on another bill. I don't remember that happening.
Well, I think the other bill was to raise the FDIC limit.
Oh, is that what it was?
But which presumably had already passed the House. It's got to be something like that. I mean, it's got to be some kind of a procedural trick. But it's an interesting question, Steve. But the fact of the matter is, it's a done deal. It's a done deal. From Steve to Steve. Steve in Westland, Michigan. Hey, Steve.
How you doing, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better.
I'm calling today because, like, not the previous caller, but the one before him said, I think we're in for it here. And this has to do with three cases coming before the Supreme Court this week. This was announced on NPR today. And if you look at them, all three of them set fascist principles of insulating corporations behind government and taking away the rights of individual citizens. One is a pharmaceutical company that claims it's not liable for giving a lady gangrene that led to the loss of an arm because of FDA labeling. Another one of these is the tobacco industry marketing light cigarettes as healthier. And another one has to do with Fox and giving the FCC broad power to censor media. And this made me cringe when I heard, because they announced that it was nothing big, like gay or abortion issues.
Right, right.
You look at all three of them set fascist principles, fascist precedents.
Corporatist, at the very least, Steve. I don't disagree. And these are real problems. And if you want more of the same, that's what we will have under McCain has said he wants clones of Alito and Scalia on the Supreme Court. There's nothing ambiguous about that at all. Bob in San Luis Obispo, listening on KYNS. Hey, Bob.
Yes, Tom. The Republican slime machine, you know, is gearing up really well, and Fox News will be repeating their points ad nauseum, and the corporate media won't be reporting anything but, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is what's going on behind the scenes, and I really thank Lee Rayburn for being on your show, pointing out the voter purging in Michigan.
Yeah.
But
it's not just happening in Michigan.
No. Michigan and Mississippi and Georgia and Louisiana all have Republicans secretaries of state.
Right.
In Ohio, the Democratic Secretary of State has actually challenged those Republicans who want to challenge voters at the ballot box.
Right.
And one of the steps she's taken is apparently she's putting two lines in for voters so they can go to an electronic voting machine if they choose, or they can vote on paper ballots if they choose.
Yeah.
And then in Wisconsin, the Democratic Secretary of State there is being challenged by the Republican Attorneys General on voter fraud.
Right.
which is the Republican mantra of, oh, we've got to get these evildoers out.
Right.
How many cases of voter fraud have actually...
Particularly in college towns like Madison.
Yeah. And it's, you know, they're coming at this from many points of attack. And
yeah, I agree. And Bob, they're doing everything they can to drive down the number of voters. It's just very simple. This is what the Republicans do, and it's what they're going to continue to do. And if they're going to steal 5 million votes this year, we got to turn out 10 million people. If they're going to steal 10 million votes, we have to turn out 15 million people. It's all about making sure that you're registered to vote. And if it's still possible for you to register to vote in whatever state you live in, check. And if you're not registered, vote, or register, and voting. And then it's even more important on election day. That's when our work actually begins. Jamie in Madrid, Spain. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Tom.
Sorry for leaving you on hold so long. I didn't notice the Spain part there on the call screening board.
It's an internet phone, so it's pretty cheap.
Oh, great. Okay. So what's up?
Something Carrie Lucas said leads right into what I wanted to talk about. Did she admit in one breath that obviously lack of regulation was part of the problem, and in the next that more regulation would just be government intervention?
Yes. Yes. This is the schizophrenic problem that the Republicans have right now, is they want to hold to their conservative principles that regulations are bad things and that football games should be fought with or should be played without referees and without rules, basically.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, they're watching a football game being played without referees and rules and saying, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't look right.
Well, my question is, how do you fight that? I mean, they've programmed so many people with this meme that anything the government does that they don't like is socialism. Reagan sold the country on this notion that, you know, government's not the solution, it's the problem.
Right.
And these people worship Reagan. I mean, I swear, they've got shrines to him.
Oh, I know.
How do you fight that?
You fight it by pointing out that they are now incoherent. You fight it by simply saying, you know, there are many things that government actually does well. There's a reason why we have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's so that we collectively can protect our commons and we can protect ourselves. It's for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence. And you know, the right to life means the right to health insurance, for example. And you know, protecting happiness means that there's some minimal threshold that you can't fall through. When I was doing my show from Denmark, we had, you know, I think it was the number two guy in the government on the show. And I said, you know, what about bankruptcies and unemployment? And, you know, we'd already disposed of medical problems causing bankruptcies. It just doesn't exist in the country. So what about people losing their jobs? And he says, well, you know, you have a couple of years of health of unemployment insurance. People will eventually find another job. Plus, you can go to college for free so they can retrain for something else. So there's a social safety net. There's not the terror.
Sure. I remember that program. There was also a special, I believe it was Bill Moyers, about international health programs.
Yeah.
And they interviewed somebody in Switzerland and asked about this issue of bankruptcy due to health care costs. And,
it just doesn't happen.
From Mars.
That's what we have to start saying, Jamie, and thank you very much for calling all the way from Madrid, Spain. This is what we have to start saying is to people, government does work in the areas where it works well.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Did my ballot go? Lost my faith in the government when they changed the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Just wanna know where my ballot went. They lost my vote. I made my choice.
Now we can't let that happen this time. We can't let it happen. That's one of the reasons you should go to your Secretary of State's office or your county clerk's office and volunteer to help with the elections. Don't just take the day off to vote. Take the day off to help everybody vote. There's actually a shortage all across the country of poll workers. And you can volunteer to help out. And just, you know, in each state, you know, different states, they have different words and different names for it. But basically, you can track it down through your, at the very worst, through the Secretary of State's office, and volunteer to be a poll worker in your local poll, in your local precinct. And or a poll observer, if not, or volunteer with the DNC or with the Obama campaign to be a poll observer. I mean, there's so many things that can be done, and so many of us are needed on election day. Consider it. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's up today?
Hey, Tom. Well, I'll tell you, obviously, the markets are not up. People are very, very spooked out about that. And it defies human understanding as to how the campaigns are going to be dealing with this. I think it's very clear the McCain campaign is simply going to start, as Sarah Palin did today in Florida, just keep banging away at Bill Ayers. In Clearwater today, she said, "I'm afraid this someone who sees America as imperfect enough to work with a former domestic terrorist who had targeted his own country," speaking of Obama.
Yeah, we're speaking of Bill Ayers, yeah. And
Bill Ayers, she was saying that this someone, it was Obama, and then she was talking about Bill Ayers.
Yeah, over at Huffington Post, there is the 30 Lies in Hannity's America, where he, you know, Hannity has done a whole special on this now. I mean, this is their Swift Boat thing. This is their, you know, you thought John Kerry was a war hero? No, he's not. And now they're doing, oh, you thought Barack Obama was a patriot and who believes and loves America? No. And this is going to be their strategy, because they know that if they talk about the issues, and frankly, if they even told the truth about Barack Obama and his personality, which is that he's a patriot, he loves this country, he has worked very, very hard for this country throughout his life. But if they told the truth, if they talked about the issues, they're toast. They're toast. All they can do is smear.
Well, that's what's happening. Also today, the president was in Cincinnati, and he was defending his judicial philosophy. He called on the Senate to move speedily to confirm judicial nominees, and, of course, that's probably not going to happen until we have a new president, or at least until the election occurs. And then he said that he actually went after the federal courts. They said they've had major impact, including those that rejected the carefully crafted procedures Congress established for detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. Then he said, and they awarded foreign terrorists held overseas legal rights previously reserved for American citizens. So he's...
Wait a minute, those are legal... you know, the Constitution doesn't say citizens, it says persons.
Yes, you're right. But as you know, they're probably doing coordination with the McCain campaign and trying to make the Democrats look like anti-patriotic, evil human beings.
Yeah, well, of course.
They can't talk about the issues. Meanwhile, there are several states right now that have Obama up big in Minnesota, some as much as 15 points, Maine up 5 points, 10 up in Washington, 10 up in New Hampshire, taking a little edge in Nevada. And I happen to know that Obama has actually been doing some radio in Nevada.
Yeah, good. Good. There's so many states in play, and I'm telling you, they are pushing so hard. I saw a Fox News special yesterday, or day before yesterday, I guess it was, in the hotel room I was in Palm Springs, that about how the whole banking crisis was all the fault of Democrats, and how the Bush administration tried to stop it. You know, nobly tried to stop it, but they were defeated by Democrats.
Well, that's what they're saying about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yeah, yeah. And this was, you know, when the Republicans controlled the House and Senate and the White House, for that matter. I mean, you know, how George Bush tried to stop this in 2001. Wait a minute. What's wrong with this picture?
It's a crazy world we live in, Tom.
Yeah, indeed, Ellen.
One other thing. Supreme Court today heard a case about Altria, they own Philip Morris, and this had to do with whether state's attorneys and individual citizens have a right to sue Altria, or whether it can only be done by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So that was kind of interesting. Also, they refused to hear an appeal by Dish Network. They challenged a judgment by a lower court in terms of who violated a patent held by TiVo. Supreme Court also said unanimous verdicts are not necessary in criminal cases dealing with state law, although it is a federal federal law that it must be unanimous.
It's very interesting. The tobacco thing, any sense of how that's going to go?
I have no sense. I have to get it from Jay, but it was unclear.
They did decide to hear that case.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I can't imagine that they can't vote that states don't have some rights.
Right. You would think, but, you know, this is a court that has put ideology above the Constitution before. And so,
yes, you're right. It would not be the first time.
I mean, you know, actually the great first example of that was in 2001, Bush v. Gore, where the Supreme Court or many in the conservative majority on this court, and there's a couple of left, Sandra Day O'Connor and Rehnquist, but ruled that the state of Florida did not have essentially the right to decide how they were going to come up with their own electoral vote.
One little last thing here. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, has begun notifying several of TV military analysts that it's probing congressional complaints. The pundits did not disclose their ties to the Pentagon. Deals with many, many television channels.
That's very interesting. So, you know, that's the is it Pravda or Izvestia thing here in the United States?
Right.
Yeah.
These guys, I'm sure, are going to get a little anxious.
Yeah, when we hear our military propaganda, we would like to know it's coming from the military. Thank you very much. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News, great news website. Check it out. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up next, Stephen Larson, a brilliant author, psychologist. We're going to talk about the fundamentalist mind for a minute. And then we'll be getting back with your calls. Stay
here. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The program News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interests. I am pleased to bring on this show one of my dear friends. In fact, I dedicated one of my books to Stephen and his wife, Robin. Stephen Larson. He's a psychologist, a professor of psychology. He worked for 20 years with Joseph Campbell. In fact, wrote the only authorized biography of Joseph Campbell, and the author of many, many brilliant books. And he has a new book out now, which you can find over at StoneMountainCenter.com or obviously Amazon.com or your favorite bookstore. StoneMountainCenter.com is Stephen's site. And the title of the book is The Fundamentalist Mind. Dr. Stephen Larson, welcome back to the show, Steve.
Hi there, Tom. So good to hear your voice.
Great to have you with us again. Why do you consider fundamentalists the most dangerous people in the world right now?
Well, it's not just any old fundamentalist, Tom, because I believe that we are them. We are all, in a sense, fundamentalists. If we've passed fully through Piaget's classical stages of development, we have a kind of an open operational attitude toward the universe in which we try to let our beliefs be open to change. And it's the people who have sort of permanently decided as a life decision or as a social decision belong to a group that the ideas that they have now are the final term, and they're determined to act these out, and everybody else is just a kind of a bit player in their
Is that your definition of a fundamentalist, somebody who has rigidified thinking and just decided this is the way it is, period, this no exceptions?
Yes, and in the book, I'm thinking of fundamentalists without qualification. That is to say, I don't consider religious fundamentalists essentially any more misguided than scientific fundamentalists or materialistic fundamentalists. Or
economic fundamentalists.
Yeah, or even New Age fundamentalists.
That's interesting.
The type of people that, when your car breaks down, think it's a karma problem, not a carburetor problem.
Right. That's very interesting. So what is it about the way that the fundamentalists conceive of the world? And we saw this here in the United States with Tim McVeigh, a Christian fundamentalist.
Yeah.
We've apparently seen it with Osama bin Laden, an Islamic fundamentalist. We saw it with George W. Bush, I don't know what kind of fundamentalist you'd call him, in his belief that war solves all problems and that the first thing you do is bomb people, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. What is it about the way that they understand the world that pushes them so often to embrace not just extreme positions but violent positions as well?
Well, the current contemporary world has become so complex and so challenging for people to master that it's easy to retreat to a simplified set of beliefs. And in a way, it's kind of a return to childhood. It's a return to turning the authority over to somebody else. That's why our chief executive can say, well, what does your father think about this? I don't talk to him. I talk to the man upstairs. So in a sense, he would have abrogated any logical responsibility or human discourse to something supernatural or beyond. And I think, Tom, that's why Thomas Jefferson tried to rewrite the Bible with the supernaturalism taken out.
And he didn't just try to, he did. The Jefferson Bible is still in print here, more than 200 years later. He just went through with a razor blade and cut out all the miracles.
Yes. And the problem with the miracles is I think there are miracles that are happening every day, but they might be the language acquisition of a child or the apparition of some beautiful phenomenon of nature. We're surrounded by miracles, but we've gained a sort of a rigidified fundamentalism of what constitutes a miracle. It's a virgin birth in the 2,000 years ago that claims our attention. And as Campbell said, that's the kind of mythology that can be a two-edged sword. Following your bliss can be a path to enlightenment or a path to world abnegation and unreality.
Yeah. How does the fundamentalist mind... we're talking with Dr. Stephen Larson and his new book, The Fundamentalist Mind, available at stonemountaincenter.com and, of course, any bookstore and on Amazon and whatnot. Stephen, how does a fundamentalist mind relate to the current U.S. elections? What are you seeing in terms of fundamentalism being played out on both the Republican and Democratic side? I'm curious about your take on that. I know you're an astute observer of these things.
Well, it's like when Ted Kennedy debated Jerry Falwell. The discussion was called mutual diatribe to the point of exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
And the worldviews of the candidates are very different. I liked both Gore and Kerry because they were people who seemed capable of appreciating the paradoxical nature of all existence and the fact that you have to keep open minds until the very last minute and then gather all the information you can before making a highly informed decision.
Which is the antithesis, the opposite of being a fundamentalist. And what you just described, I believe, is Barack Obama's leadership style.
Well, he does seem to lean in that direction far more than the candidate. And
John McCain.
I was an admirer of John McCain when he came out against torture, having been tortured himself and knowing what that can be like. But I think torture can also affect people, and it may have made him angry and, convinced in some ways that his cause is right or the only one. And,
well, he also voted, while he spoke out against torture, he voted with George Bush to allow torture.
Seems that way.
Yeah.
And I'm... when common, ordinary people like you and I, Tom, understand that it's folly to go into war and the outcome is predictable, I can't understand how the supposedly best minds in the country can make that decision. That's a very simplistic kind of thing, and then say things like either you're for us or against us. That's a
right.
Polarizing, dichotomizing tendency. And Tom, you're aware of the same brain science and neurofeedback literature that I am, and the human brain is enormously susceptible to dichotomies. The dichotomies are built into the very structure of it. And so when you have software, which is lousy mythology that tells you the world is black and white, why, by God, you might believe it and start acting out of a black and white agenda.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
And as we've seen over and over and over again, here's the fundamentalist Osama bin Laden saying that his goal is to bleed America dry financially. I mean, he came right out and said this in 1998.
Does that mean he's joined the Republican Party?
Yeah, well, apparently. I mean, he's said this a number of times.
They seem to have the same agenda now.
So.
Well, that's my point. And the somebody, you know, the what he does is he scares us, and then we behave in a way that is exactly the behavior that he wants. How do we stop as a nation responding to a fundamentalist fear tactic with a fundamentalist response? How do we go beyond that?
That's a heck of a good question, but I think one good question to ask yourself is, who's the better chess player?
Yeah.
If somebody is strategizing that we're going to have a knee-jerk reflex a couple of steps down the line, why then they're, in a sense, strategizing ahead of us. And in that case, Bin Laden is a couple of jumps ahead of us. And why he's still at liberty after, 8 years is a great mystery. But he seems to be out-strategizing us when our leadership makes the knee-jerk predictable response. We need somebody who makes an unpredictable response that trumps the last foray of the other guys.
Right. We're talking to Dr. Stephen Larson, StoneMountainCenter.com, his new book, The Fundamentalist Mind. Stephen, what percentage of people are fundamentalists, and does it vary from country to country, from culture to culture?
You know, that's a wonderful question, and I would be hard put to come up with a demographic on it, even though I think such a thing could be assembled. But, you know, Tom, it starts way back in ancient China with the Taoists and the Confucians. And there's really no question who's the, you know, Republicans and the Democrats, the conservatives and the liberals. Any human population tends to form a bell-shaped curve based on values. Does half the group clings to old traditional values, half wants to embrace an open-ended, you know, kind of forward-looking agenda, which can also be quite crazy because sometimes as soon as a new revolution comes along, like the People's Revolution in China, it gets awfully fundamentalist.
French Revolution is a great
example. It starts telling people how to think and what to do according to a fixed agenda. And as far as Joseph Campbell was concerned, that's why he hated communism. You can't. He doesn't like traditions that start telling you how to think. That's attacking the creature at its very core.
Right, and that's what we're hearing now. I mean, the centerpiece of the McCain campaign right now is that Obama hangs out with a terrorist, right? In other words, you know, telling us who to be afraid of and how to think. And by the way, don't talk about the economy. Dr. Stephen Larson, you can check out his book at StoneMountainCenter.com or Amazon.com, or ask for it in your local bookstore. The Fundamentalist Mind, just out. Stephen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where despair is not an option. Our full Monty alert for the day.
Take off your coat. Real slow.
Well, there's no such thing as a free lunch anymore for the Black Frog restaurant patrons. Nervy enough to run down a dock and plunge naked into Moosehead Lake. Yeah, it used to be if you did that, you got a free lunch. They called it the skinny dip sandwich. But then the selectmen in the tourist town of Greenville, Maine, decided this wasn't something they liked. Yeah, just leave your hat on. So they said, sorry, we're not going to renew your liquor license. So the owner of the Black Frog has changed his policy. According to the Black Frog's website, by the way, its sandwiches also include the chicken that didn't make it across the road. And one of the house rules is no food fights unless specifically authorized by your server. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. This is interesting. The Guardian is reporting This was in the Sunday paper, the Sunday Guardian. Now Wall Street may shun $700 billion bailout. Fears are mounting that many Wall Street banks and financial firms will refuse to participate in the U.S. government's $700 billion bailout package, leaving global markets and world economies in a perilous state for months to come. Thomas Caldwell, chairman and CEO of Caldwell Financial, a $1 billion-plus fund manager, says there is a growing feeling that banks might instead decide to tough it out. Interesting. Maybe we didn't need to give George Bush almost $1 trillion. I don't know. You know, can you imagine if that legislation had not passed and the market dropped 500-600 points today as it's doing right now? Can you imagine what they'd be saying? Oh, it's you Democrats, you didn't pass that legislation. Look at this. It's a disaster. That's why at the time I said, well, this is not the legislation that I like. And if I was in Congress, I would vote against this. I am not going to condemn any Democrat who votes for this. This was an absolute lose-lose. And that's why Bush and Paulson pushed it as hard as they did. And Paulson, at a certain level, I have vilified Henry Paulson in the past on this program. And I read a piece about him in The Economist as I was flying home from Palm Springs yesterday. And the guy's a Christian Scientist, which is kind of outside the realm of the Bushies. The guy was the former head or chairman of the board of one of the largest pro-wildlife charities in the United States and is leaving much, if not most, of his considerable fortune to that. He's a leading advocate in favor of endangered species and a leading proponent of the idea that we are causing global warming, which is destroying the earth. I mean, might not be such a bad guy. Maybe he got suckered in. I don't know. Although, you know, on the other hand, he was the chairman of Goldman Sachs, and he made $700 million there, now down to $500 million. And, so was Robert Rubin, and it's hard to know. It's really hard to know. I don't think we're ever going to know the whole story. All we just know is that something is wrong. Something is very wrong. Darren, and we don't make things in the United States anymore. Darren in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Darren, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing?
Just great.
I just wanted to share with everybody that I think that they could protect themselves when they go and vote by taking a picture of the electronic voting machine that has a date stamp on it, and to take camcorders and document everything that goes on while they're at the polling place.
It won't do any good, Darren.
If
after the election, if you show up with a picture of your vote, they're going to say, yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you need to do, what we need as many people as possible to do, is either volunteer to be a poll worker. So if there's any anomalies or any weirdness going on, you can help. You can be part of the solution rather than the problem. In other words, you can help stop it, number one. Be a poll worker or a poll observer, or go to the Obama campaign or the Democratic Party, Democrats.org, and volunteer to be a poll observer. A participant, or volunteer with one of the, there's a whole bunch of great groups and verifiedvoting.org, blackboxvoting.org. I mean, check out some of the sites where you've got people where they're organizing people, markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com, Mark's blog, where they're organizing people to be poll watchers, they're organizing people to look for fraud in this election. That's something that needs to be done. Ryan in Tennessee. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Okay. I got a couple of Republican friends who, you know, they want socialism. They're so burnt out by this bailout. They're really steamed. They see, like, their friends who are losing their houses. But they want socialism. Socialism, they just can't say it. They can't say the word. They're so brainwashed to, like, rush and, whatever they've done to them. It's like,
I
have a conversation with them, and we're agreeing on everything. You know, we need to get more like how the European countries are and everything. And then he's like, yeah, we need less regulation. And I'm like, well, no, we need, you're actually talking about more regulation, right? And then, you know, he's thinking about it for a second. Well, we have a lot of laws, and if we could just get like how they have the free markets over there in Europe, I'm like, we have the free markets. They have the regulated markets. And
right.
He thinks it's the opposite. It's
right.
Really bad. You know?
Yeah, anybody who says we should just be more like Europe really needs to go over to Europe and find out, you know, yeah, the social democratic countries. Ryan, thank you very much. Very well said.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah.
Roosevelt is dead.
And so is Reagan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Unbalanced. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Show, 34 minutes past the hour. John McCain in the presidential debate, the first of the three presidential debates. John McCain on the banking crisis.
Warned about corporate greed and excess and CEO pay and all that.
Say what, John? You what?
Warned about corporate greed and excess and CEO pay and all that. A lot of us saw this train wreck coming.
Okay, so let's go to John McCain a year earlier in New Hampshire being interviewed by the Keene Sentinel, 2007.
But I don't really know of hardly anybody who, with the exception of a handful, that said, wait a minute, this thing is getting completely out of hand and is overheating. I'd like to tell you I did anticipate it, but I have to give you straight talk. I did not.
That was November 2007. So from that time, from November 2007 until the debates, John McCain has gone from, you know, I didn't see this thing coming to, yeah, I saw it coming. I was warning about it. Oh, man. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Liz in Valley Glen, California, listening on K-Talk in Los Angeles. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, good morning. I wanted to talk about Barney Frank. But before that, all your conversations this morning reminded me of little adages my mother had, like the goose, killing the goose that lays the golden egg, mm-hmm. the Republicans,
yeah.
and people who live in glass houses shouldn't be throwing stones, Mrs. Palin, because
mm-hmm.
Obviously what people say that's politically correct and thinking, oh, she's got a daughter that's knocked up, and she's whoring around with her husband's partner, is what they're really thinking in their mind. Anyway, but
according to the National Enquirer, which, according to Michelle Malkin, is always right.
But anyway, what I thought might be a good idea is to have a telephone campaign to Barney Frank, so he has an oversight committee, and if he has to call in the Secretary of the Treasury every day, that's what it, so be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the oversight provisions of this legislation are pretty meaningless. They're advisory. They don't have teeth. But Congress still has some teeth and still has the power of the purse and can still pass a law pulling this thing back. But I think right now, frankly, A, that's not going to happen, Liz, and probably it wouldn't be a good thing for it to happen. I think that the Democrats need to get out of the way because the sky is about to fall, and you know, they don't want it to fall on them. There's going to be a huge blame game here, and the Republicans, this will be the second Republican Great Depression, and arguably the third, and the Republicans don't want it to be labeled or branded as the Republican Great Depression, and so right now they are doing everything they can, and thank you for the call, Liz. I, for example, there's a YouTube video out there that is circulating like crazy in the right wing, just among Republicans. I've probably gotten 100 of them that have been sent to me where people say, you know, my brother-in-law sent this to me, my nephew. I mean, probably half the Republicans in America have seen this YouTube video. And basically what it shows is a bunch of Democrats, all of whom, by the way, by coincidence, of course, happen to be African Americans, a bunch of Democratic members of Congress defending Franklin Raines, defending Fannie and Freddie, saying we got plenty of regulation, all is well. And a couple of Republicans saying, hey, we've got a problem here and we've got to regulate this and we've got to pay closer attention to it. And what this video does, you watch this video and by the time you're done watching it, you say, holy cow, look at this. The Democrats caused this. Republicans tried to stop it. When in fact, what it is, you know, if, and the Democrats need to pony some money up to do this because this was, somebody spent a pile of money making this thing because they must have had to have looked through thousands, tens of thousands of hours of C-SPAN video to find those clips. And it's just highly selective editing of, yes, there were some Democratic members of Congress, there were some African-American Democratic members of Congress, among others. But in this video, they only show the African-American ones. I mean, the racist subtext is unmistakable. But nonetheless, there were some who were saying, yeah, everything's fine. And there were some who were corrupted by the process. And there were some who were taking money from the industry. And there were some who thought, yeah, hey, we're having a great time. Let's not pop the bubble. And there were a lot of Republicans as well saying the same thing. And there were many Democrats calling for regulation. And there were some Republicans. It can be spun either way. And the Republicans are spending an enormous amount of money and time right now to spin it that this all started under Clinton, this crisis, you know, blah, 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 blah. George in El Paso, Texas. Hey, George.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's up?
Well, I guess following up on the comment you just made, yesterday I was watching some kind of a documentary they had on Fox News. I think it was called Saving Our Economy.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it was about the economic crisis that we're currently facing. And basically, according to the documentary, this whole mess apparently started, you know, during the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, apparently in an attempt to try to provide affordable housing to Americans who couldn't get housing.
Yeah, and this is how they lie about this stuff. Because, yes, the Clinton administration was pushing for affordable housing for people who couldn't get it. And the main focus of their push, and you'll find lots of speeches and comments to that effect, the main focus of their push was to stop things like redlining, to stop the practices of saying, oh, because you live in a certain neighborhood, we're not going to give you credit and things like that. But it wasn't, hey, let's do away with the regulations. That was Phil Gramm in 1999 with Gramm Leach Bliley, or Gramm Bliley Leach, whatever the legislation was called, that, you know, that blew this thing up, among other things. Now, there were some people, you know, you had Bob Rubin and Lawrence Summers. I mean, there were some free market so-called ideologues in the Clinton administration. But by and large, this push for deregulation didn't come out of the Clinton administration. It started with the Reagan administration. And in some ways, Clinton went along with it. But really, it was the Bush administration who put it on steroids. And we need to, you know, just remember, this is George W. Bush in October of 2002.
Freddie Mac recently began 25 initiatives around the country to dismantle barriers and create greater opportunities for homeownership. One of the programs is designed to help deserving families who have bad credit histories to qualify for homeownership loans. You don't have to have a lousy home for first-time home buyers. You put your mind to it, the first-time home buyer, the low-income home buyer, can have just as nice a house as anybody else.
See, and that was George W. Bush. And so when the Democrats talked about let's get everybody in this game, they were talking about let's do away with the institutional barriers, the essentially racist barriers that exist.
Yes.
When the Republicans were talking about it, they were talking about let's get rid of the regulations. And there's George W. Bush bragging about it. So, you're absolutely right. Fox did that special. I saw a piece of that, and it's reprehensible. It's absolutely reprehensible. And this is the Republican spin. They are trying they're trying, and with some people, they have succeeded in blaming this thing on Democrats, even though the Republicans have been running the show. Daryl in Farmington Hills, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Daryl.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, it's obviously that was a redundant question. You're sounding good today, and you're right on target. Real quickly, want to mention that in Michigan, today is the last day for registration.
Okay, so if you live in Michigan, be sure to get out and register to vote today.
Yes, get to your city clerk office and make sure you get your identification in and make sure you're on the rolls.
Right.
The bill that was passed that seemed to be generated by the Senate, and they had some questions around how this actually worked. They took a House bill that had already been passed by the House, and it had something to do with money in it,
mm-hmm.
and carved it out by generating an amendment, which basically said, scratch everything else that's in the bill, and here's what we want to write.
Right.
So they had a money bill that they had yet to vote on, and they took it, changed it by process of amendment, which can involve, the process of amendment can involve taking out paragraphs of other bills, and presented it as, well, it sounds like it's a new bill. Of course, they changed the name of the bill, so it's
right.
In fact a new bill, But the way that this happens is by taking a bill that was originated in the House, having to do with monetary spending.
Right. It was an appropriation bill, and
yeah.
sending it back as a modified appropriation.
Modified appropriation bill.
Yeah.
And that means the House has to pass again, and take it to joint conference.
Joint
conference.
Yeah, makes perfect sense, Daryl. Daryl, thanks a lot for clarifying that. I appreciate it. And that was my expectation, and it does make sense. Diane in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Diane.
Hello, Tom. I have a suggestion for teenagers who may
mm-hmm.
be frustrated that they can't vote in an election that's going to have such dramatic impact on their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They may not be able to cast a ballot, but I think they could help a lot of other people cast theirs. In St. Louis County, and I'm guessing other counties and states, there's a program where 15 to 17-year-olds can volunteer to be trained to use Palm Pilots to help facilitate voting.
Hmm.
And that can, of course, help reduce those long lines, which, of
right.
course, discourage voters.
Right.
So I just wanted to pass that along because I know there are...
Is there a website for that, Diane?
Well, St. Louis County Board of Elections is where I found that information, but I'm guessing it happens elsewhere. And I
so
know
this is the county doing this?
St. Louis County Board of Elections.
That's great.
Yes, I think it's fantastic. And I happen to know that a number of school districts are going to be closed on Election Day for
mm-hmm.
various reasons. So, I mean, these teenagers might, you know, realize here is a great opportunity to really participate in a meaningful way and
right.
Not have to miss school.
Yeah.
So I
yeah.
just wanted to pass it on because I had not heard about that before. And I thought it was a great way for teenagers who are going to be so affected by this election to
yes.
maybe have some impact.
Yeah, very well said. Thank you, Diane. I appreciate
the
call. Thank you. I mean, this, she says, Diane says they're going to be so affected by this election. This $700 billion, for example, this was just borrowed. And it's going to be paid back 10 and 20 years from now. Guess who's going to be paying it back? The people who are teenagers right now. This is right in the middle of their working lives. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Jobs overseas. Red Chinese have all our debt. They blew the budget. You botched the rack. We're taking our country back. One Senate seat at a time, one House seat at a time, one State House seat at a time, one State Assembly seat at a time. Larry Zamba's with us, Small Business Entrepreneur's website, electzamba, ZAMBA.com. He's running for the Wisconsin Assembly, District 66, against the Republican incumbent Samantha Kernan. Or Kirkman, excuse me. And Larry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I'm more than happy to be on. It's been a pleasure just listening to you.
Well, thank you. We're going to start doing it a couple times a week now. Progressives in races all around the country, where if our listeners get to their website, like electazamba.com, and toss a few bucks their way or offer to help out in some way, maybe we can turn this country around. Your website is incredibly compelling. It's brilliantly done. Electzamba.zamba.com. Your positions, your Larry's positions. Here's this little girl, sweet little girl looking up at the camera with one hand. Her right hand is missing. It says, this 2-year-old child living in our district is missing her right hand. Dad is disabled from a motorcycle accident. Her mom is also on disability because of a work-related injury. Mom lost their job. Health insurance will always be a problem for this family. Though this child's handicap is unusual, her story is not unique. And then you say, wherever you see a coffee can in a gas station asking for spare change for a child's operation, that is our healthcare system at work. That is Republican Representative Samantha Kirkman's healthcare plan in action.
Pretty much that or don't get sick.
Yeah, yeah. And you point out that she says that health savings accounts are the solution, and most people like this child's family can't even afford a health savings account, much less health insurance.
Absolutely. And that's the number one thing in the district that I'm running into right now. Even with the the bailout and rising and falling right now, gas prices, healthcare 80% of the time is still the issue. And that's just not off of me going to targeted lists, but just door to door and listening to thousands of people. They can't take it anymore. And so that's why it's number one on my website.
We're talking with Larry Zamba, Z-A-M-B-A, electzamba.com is website. He's running for the Wisconsin Assembly, District 66, against Republican against a Republican incumbent. And
yes.
Larry, first of all, tell us about District 66. Where is this in Wisconsin?
It's in Kenosha County, and it also includes part of Racine County, the area known as Burlington. And it's
okay,
kind
so
of a really
for somebody who's never been to Wisconsin, where you know what kind of a district is that, and where is it?
It had been Republican leaning out in Burlington, pretty solidly Democratic in the urban part of the city. And as you moved out west, it kind of changed, but away from Lake Michigan. But what had happened is, as I look at the canvassing numbers right now, it shows I actually have a significant lead over my opponent. It's just times are changing compared to where they were in 06 and 04.
That's great. That is
yeah.
great. And you know, we're seeing that happening all over the country as people are just saying, you know, this Republican laissez-faire, let them eat cake attitude that we've had for 26 years now under, you know, or 28 years since Reagan was elected has just destroyed this country. And we want our country back.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been listening to you religiously speak about how the Democrats kind of take a back seat when it comes to political theater.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, we'd actually maybe went over the top a few times, but we really enjoyed it. Last weekend, we had our own reenactment of the Boston Tea Party, complete with drummers and patriots and heaving the crates in the into the local lake here. We did fish them out, but at that point, I issued a challenge to my competitor, who has never once taken up an opponent on a debate. We've done a lot of other things like that. We, you know, guerrilla marketing, basically.
That's great.
What we got, yeah.
That is absolutely great. Larry, I'm so glad. We're talking with Larry Zamba. Zamba, electzamba.com is the website, Z-A-M-B-A. Larry, what brought you into politics? What did you do before this?
Well, I work as a photographer and a graphic designer and a painter. You know, to be honest, I kept listening to progressive radio over and over, though being a child of the 60s, it took 40 years for this to ferment to the point where I just couldn't take it anymore. I had to do what actually something you talk about all the time, which is it's no longer enough to vote. You have to get involved. And so after slugging it out a bit through a primary and winning that, I said, you know, this is quite doable. And I've totally decided that whether I win or lose this election, I've already come out a winner from all the stories I've heard and all the things I've learned along the way. And I would invite anybody or everybody they can to get involved more than just voting or sticking up a sign. It's a tremendous experience.
Yeah, democracy is too great a gift. It's too vital a thing. This nation is too important. We love it too much to say, okay, it's just enough to vote. And which, you know, on top of that, you get, you know, half of the Americans are not even voting, but it's
yeah.
still, it's
and
not.
You mentioned earlier on your show, I believe that it's looking like they're trying to purge 30% of the new registered in this state, voters. It's just part of the plan. So everybody on my staff is set up as a special deputy registrar to vote. I probably myself personally have signed up at least 40 to 50 people to vote. Every day I'm out there, I've got my little clipboard with me. Signing
That's
up
great.
To vote.
God bless you. Good on you, Larry. Larry
Thanks.
Zamba, the website is elect, E-L-E-C-T, Zamba, Z-A-M-B-A.com. Get over there, toss a few bucks his way, and help out. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great, great talking with you, and good luck. Coming up tomorrow, Bruce Fein, the columnist for the Washington Times and author of a new book, Constitutional Peril, a conservative on the destruction of the Bush administration, plus Dr. Marjorie Cohn and I will be discussing why America should be concerned about the possibility of a McCain-Palin administration. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.